All right, greetings, everybody. Thanks very much for coming out tonight. I hope you appreciate my voice. It's a little sing-songy, but think of it as the entertainment for the evening as it goes up and down. It's great to see. I'm glad you're out for the second part of a conversation on this important matter of the Constitution and the protection of LGBT rights. For many in this country, it's a controversial issue. For others, it's simply a matter of equal protection of the law. But let me thank KISU for being here to broadcast this talk, and it will be rebroadcast next Tuesday, August 13th at 7 o'clock, which is a good thing. So if you fall asleep tonight, you can actually listen to it next time. Last week, we outlined in a broad way the evolution of the Supreme Court's rulings on the matter of LGBT rights in the Constitution. And we saw the court moving steadily toward the concept of equal protection of the law for all people. And that was primarily under the leadership of Justice Kennedy. Tonight, we take a look at more edgy issues. Edgy issues described nationally as religious freedoms versus gay rights. I think it's unfortunate that it's cast that way, but that is indeed how it has been cast, and that's partly attributable to the fact that the Masterpiece Cake case that came before the Supreme Court a couple of years ago was a case in which both parties tried to pitch it that way, religious liberties against gay rights. Hence, the framework has been established for us. Tonight, I want to begin to talk about this issue within the context of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment, ratified in 1868, you'll recall, provides that no state shall make or enforce any law denying to any person within its jurisdiction, quote, the equal protection of the law. If we as a society decide to treat some people as not deserving equal protection of the law, then that means that we raise the question, well, what justifies an exemption? How do we justify the practice of prohibiting protections for certain groups? The Equal Protection Clause, of course, was drafted by the 39th Congress with an eye toward making blacks equal to whites in the eyes of the law. And the 14th Amendment was the centerpiece of the Reconstruction Amendments. It only occurred to the Supreme Court many years later that the Equal Protection Clause could be expanded to protect other groups, including women, although it took forever to do so. And as we remarked briefly last week, it did not occur until 1971 in Reed versus Reed, a famous case coming out of Idaho. With respect to LGBT rights, we see that we're still not fully there. Hence the question of when public businesses may deny their services, their goods and services, to members of the LGBT community. So let's take a step back from that framework and recognize the two claims on both parts. On the one hand, as Justice Kennedy decided, as he described in the opinion for the court in Masterpiece coming out of Colorado a couple of years ago, he said what we have here is the assertion by the state of Colorado to pass laws to protect citizens within its jurisdiction. And the state of Colorado had passed an anti-discrimination statute, or what we might call a public accommodations law. And that sought to expand protection on the basis of sexual orientation, going beyond the federal civil rights protection as reflected in the landmark statute, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits discrimination against people based on race, color, national origin, and the reality is that that's the statute that has served so well to protect African Americans as well as other minorities. The state of Colorado, as I say, wanted to go beyond that protection and add to the list sexual orientation, which a couple dozen states have done. It is the subject of considerable controversy here in Idaho, as you know. As a footnote, you'll know that for the better part of 10 years, advocates of, quote, add the words here in Idaho have been lobbying the Idaho legislature to add sexual orientation to those other iconic classes. It's not succeeded yet. You may also be aware of the fact that several cities here in Idaho, including Boise and Sandpoint and places in between, have passed a public accommodations statute so as to protect people on the basis of sexual orientation, adding that protection again to the historic list. The city of Idaho Falls is currently discussing the possibility of adopting a public accommodations law, and you know that the mayor and the city council just recently decided to establish a committee to look closely at that. I hope tonight, as we dive into the masterpiece case, that we'll begin to understand some of the edges and the controversies to this. At the outset, let's remember that when we look at the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and its protection against discrimination based on religion and color and national origin and race, that those categories have an interesting characteristic to them. When we take a look at race, when we take a look at color and national origin, we're taking a look at protection for people born the way they are. Nobody can choose the color of their skin. Nobody can choose their race. Nobody can choose their national origin. So there's protection based on what the Supreme Court has called facts of life, or sometimes called accidents of birth. When the Civil Rights Act provides protection based on religion, it is essentially providing protection for people who make a choice to embrace one religion or another. So the very fact that sexual orientation has not been placed in this category raises a question. Why would states and cities permit protection against people for an accident of birth or a fact of life? That question constitutes a big, broad background for us as we move forward. The masterpiece cake issue, for all of the discussion and the controversy that surrounded it, did not amount to much. The reality is that both parties, those defending the owner of the cake shop and those that were defending the rights of a gay couple to order a cake, had hoped that the Supreme Court would tackle the merits of the case. It did not. And so what we might say, after many, many months, the court labored and brought forth a mouse. All we got out of this case in the end was a determination, as you'll see from the facts, a determination that the court was not going to reach the merits because there were what we call difficult vehicles at work. Court insiders sometimes use the term difficult vehicles, which is to say the facts and the record did not align to quite tee up the issues the way both sides had hoped the court might. That is to say, advocates of freedom of religion wanted a resounding victory for freedom of religion. Advocates of gay rights had hoped for a resounding victory advocating gay rights. So what did happen? When a man named Jack Phillips, who owned a bakery, was approached by a gay couple about to be married in another state, remember this occurs in Colorado, about to be married in another state, they asked the owner of the bakery to bake them a cake so that they could celebrate their forthcoming marriage. The owner, Jack Phillips, refused because, he said, it violates the concept of same-sex marriage, violates his religious viewpoints. And so he refused. The couple, a man named David and a man named Charlie, lodged a complaint with the Colorado Civil Rights Commission to say that they've been the victims of discrimination in violation of the Colorado Civil Rights Act, which added, as I say, a protected category known as sexual orientation. The Colorado Civil Rights Commission conducted an investigation, held a hearing, and determined indeed that the owner of the bakery had denied had engaged in discrimination against the same-sex couple. On appeal to the High Appellate Court in Colorado, the appellate court upheld the decision reached by the Civil Rights Commission. There was no appeal to the Colorado Supreme Court, so it went directly to the U.S. Supreme Court. Justice Anthony Kennedy, who had written the landmark decisions involving gay rights that we talked about last time we met, including Romer versus Evans out of Colorado, Lawrence versus Texas, and of course Obergefell, the gay marriage case, now had an opportunity to extend his legacy. Let's make it clear that the same-sex marriage case had not yet come before the court at the time that the same-sex couple had approached Jack Phillips. That would come a couple of years. So Phillips argued a couple of things. He said that I will not bake a cake for this couple because it violates my religious beliefs. There is currently no law of the land that permits people to engage in same-sex marriage. And I refuse to bake the cake. So the Supreme Court, then in a 7-2 decision written by Justice Kennedy, might have had the opportunity to reach the merits, but it didn't because of the vehicular problem, as I say. That is, the case was not set up in a correct way for the court to address the merits of the question. Instead, Justice Kennedy wrote that the Civil Rights Commission in Colorado had engaged in, quote, religious hostility toward the owner of the bakery. How was this exhibited? At a hearing before the Civil Rights Commission, Kennedy recorded, some members of the commission, in asking questions of Jack Phillips and making comments, said two things in particular. When the gay couple had said that, in fact, their rights were being violated, and the owner of the baker said, no, my rights to religious freedom are being violated, a couple of commissioners responded by saying, invocation of religious beliefs is one of the oldest ways to dodge an exercise in the sale of goods and the supply of products. Worse than that, the commissioner said, it was at the bottom of slavery. It was even at the bottom of the Holocaust. So don't try to argue to us that you can hide behind your religious beliefs. To many people, the comments by those commissioners seem to be harsh. They certainly seem to be harsh to the Supreme Court and to Justice Kennedy. Given that the comments were harsh and exhibited what we call animosity toward religious beliefs, Justice Kennedy decided that the cake baker would win the case in the 7-2 decision, I should say. Decided that the cake baker would win the case because of the exhibition of religious animosity. There was no effort by the Civil Rights Commission, Justice Kennedy wrote, to treat religious rights in a neutral manner, invoking an old test going back to 1949, in which the Supreme Court had said that it's the responsibility of government to treat religions in a quote-unquote neutral manner. We'll explain that a bit. Given that finding, then Kennedy determined it was not possible to reach the merits of the case, which is to say then both parties left with less than satisfaction. What was the satisfaction that both parties were seeking? On the one hand, the owner of the bakery, Jack Phillips, was advocating the idea that he enjoyed broad religious freedoms to refuse to provide a cake to a gay couple. He also argued on the appeal that he had a free speech interest here. What's interesting about this is that before the Civil Rights Commission and on appeal to the Colorado Appellate Court, the only claim made was on religion. After that, the record was amended to the U.S. Supreme Court to squeeze in a free speech claim, and this would have created a quote-unquote hybrid right for Phillips, both, that is, both a right of religion and a right of free speech. What would be the strategy behind that for his attorneys? Because the Supreme Court has exhibited a great deal more deference to individuals when a hybrid right of speech and religion is invoked rather than standing on merely one right or the other. But there was another strategy behind Jack Phillips' assertion of free speech, one that if it had been embraced by the Supreme Court, would have spread a very chill wind across the land. Because if the Supreme Court had said to Jack Phillips, your right to free speech has been violated by virtue of an artistic right to decide whether to bake a cake or not, then it not only would have supplied many grounds across the country for owners of companies to discriminate against members of the LGBT community, but more fundamentally, it would have permitted discrimination against women and minorities as well, because anytime an owner of a business, a theater, a restaurant, a carriage service, the like, could say, I'm not going to engage in service because it offends my right of free speech, that would have opened up such a huge hornet's nest that anybody might have been victimized by the assertion of a free speech interest. And Justice Kennedy himself said, I'm not sure if there is even a freedom of religion issue here. I don't know if the refusal to sell a cake is a matter of free speech or is a matter of freedom of religion. Those issues, he said, will await future cases. And indeed, there are cases coming up the judicial pipeline right now. Another case, for example, coming out of Oregon involving yet another bakery. A case involving a florist coming out of Washington. All of these folks are refusing service to members of the LGBT community. Now, Justice Kennedy did remind his reading audience that the Supreme Court back in 1968 had refused to endorse the assertion of religious principles as justification to deny services to African Americans. And the court, in a long string of decisions, had held consistently that, again, if an owner of a business can assert a religious reason for denying services to African Americans, then the floodgates are open, and it would be hard to know whether and when the owner of a company has a sincerely held religious belief or is simply invoking it so as to refuse service, perhaps on some other grounds, perhaps in the terms of racial hostility back in the 60s, and now simply hostility toward the rights of gay Americans. So Kennedy said, quite rightly, that we'll await other cases to address these issues. Let's ask ourselves, what are the foundational assertions here? Let's turn first of all to freedom of religion. It's the First Amendment of the Constitution that provides Congress shall make no law abridging the free exercise of religion. Lots of Americans engage in pretty compelling, pretty vibrant discussions about what that language means. What constitutes freedom of religion? We start with the observation that no right in the Bill of Rights, no right, no liberty is absolute. The framers of our Constitution made that clear. The framers of the Bill of Rights made that clear. So always the question to be debated is, what constitutes a reasonable regulation of the assertion of any right? Free speech, freedom of religion, freedom to petition government, and the Second Amendment, for example, which has come up a time or two. So the question always is, what is the protected scope of the right being asserted? Freedom of religion was certainly very important to the founders of this nation, and all because it had to do with freedom of conscience. Both Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, among the early founders, asserted the great importance of freedom of conscience and distinguished the right to choose to worship, if that's what you choose, or to choose not to worship. The free exercise clause runs in harness with the establishment clause. The establishment clause is the other protection of the First Amendment, which reads, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. At the time of the founding, an establishment of religion meant not merely a prohibition on the establishment of a state or national church, but also in America, the prohibition on any governmental aid to religion, support to a religion, or preference of a religion. Both clauses had the same goal, and that was to, as fully as possible, to protect the right of individuals to worship as they please. But over the course of 200 years, or more properly, over the course of the last century or so since freedom of religion cases began coming before the Supreme Court, the court has struggled a bit to determine what is the outline of protection for the assertion of religious liberties. In 1949, in a case called New Jersey versus Everson, the Supreme Court gave voice for the first time to the idea that government should not be hostile to religion, nor may it support religion, thus reflecting both the Free Exercise Clause as well as the Establishment Clause. And that was a fascinating case in which the court did invoke the neutrality test. The reality is that the case is an interesting one. It involved a common practice among states back then, where states would reimburse parents for busing their children to schools, public schools, parochial schools. A particular father decided that the practice of funding state transportation of school kids to a Catholic church offended the Establishment Clause because that constituted state support of a religion. Didn't matter how many pennies of the state fund were actually being contributed to bus kids to a Catholic school, the very fact that the state was sending kids to a Catholic school where they would receive religious instruction offended the Establishment Clause. But the Supreme Court upheld the state statute and said that the state needs to be neutral in its treatment of all of its citizens, particularly here students, and said, as long as there is a program to bus kids to public schools, then it's within the authority of the state to bus kids to parochial schools. And so that was the beginning of the neutrality test. As nice as it sounds, it's not always the case that it's easy to apply. And the Idaho Supreme Court disagreed. In 1958, in a case called Engelking versus Idaho, the Idaho Supreme Court struck down the state transportation system for busing school kids to a parochial school, holding that it violated the Idaho Constitution's equivalent of the Establishment Clause. So you see that across the country, people would have different views of what constituted an Establishment Clause violation. It's in the area of freedom of religion where people often engage in heated discussions, because many people will invoke freedom of religion as an absolute right, that they could do anything they want in the name of religion. And in the 1950s, the 1940s, the 1960s, as I've said, owners of businesses were quick to deny their services to African Americans. They were hiding behind the freedom of religion clause as a means of masking their racial hostility to African Americans. The Supreme Court saw through that and thus struck down the invocation of freedom of religion, thus setting the stage for consideration of just how far we citizens can go in asserting religious freedom against a state interest in protecting classes of people. So what the Supreme Court said in that particular case in 1968 is the state has the authority to pass laws and to establish regulations to protect African Americans. That's what Justice Kennedy alluded to in the masterpiece Cake decision, and did also assert that the state has a right to protect the dignity of members of the LGBT community. He did not indicate he was hostile to the state law at all. What concerned him was the behavior of the commissioners on the Civil Rights Commission. In a dissenting opinion, it was Justice Ginsburg who pointed out there's nothing about speech or religion involved in selling a cake to a customer. What's of greater interest, she wrote, was the fact that all businesses, once they open their doors, are required to treat all customers alike. What might be, if you're looking for a dodge for a baker, what might be one way out is if a baker sells only those cakes on display, chooses never to make a special cake for any customers, heterosexuals or homosexuals alike, then that person would not be in the position of being viewed as a person violating the rights of the LGBT community. But probably a bakery that establishes that business practice is not going to do very well and is not going to have a thriving practice. On the other side of the religion issue, then, is the assertion of equal protection for members of the LGBT community. As we said before, we've seen the evolution of the Supreme Court's decision over 20 years and a number of opinions written by Justice Kennedy, and that's the essence of his legacy. Remember in Lawrence versus Texas in 2003, that he wrote an opinion striking down the Texas law that sought to punish homosexual acts of sodomy on the grounds that it violated the dignity and the right of citizens to engage in intimate relations. It was Justice O'Connor in a concurring opinion who said, more than that, it's a matter of equal protection of law, by which she meant no state can prosecute as criminal acts, heterosexual acts of sodomy without punishing homosexual acts of sodomy. It's that principle of equal protection then that might likely win out as the court hears cases coming forward. Now this whole issue of religious rights against gay rights has become a cause célèbre among different cultures in the country. Right-wing conservatives view it as an assault on freedom of religious choice and believe that, as Justice Scalia said back in a dissenting opinion in Lawrence versus Texas, that in fact it contributes to the downfall of Western society and Western culture. Now, how do we try to sort out this conflict? Interestingly, we can turn to an opinion by Justice Scalia himself, a 1989 decision in Employment Division versus Smith, a case coming out of Oregon, where two people were arrested for smoking peyote, and they tried to claim when they were arrested that they were engaging in the act of smoking peyote as a religious practice. And I think the theory was, the more peyote they smoke, the higher they get, the closer to God they become, or some sort of reasoning. The question was, since the state of Oregon had a law that prohibited peyote, was there essentially a religious exception? When Justice Scalia wrote the opinion for the court denying a religious exemption, that probably shocked a lot of his followers, and certainly does to this day, because he said there cannot be a religious exemption from an otherwise neutral, generally applicable law. Justice Gorsuch, in a concurring opinion in the Masterpiece case, alluded to the opinion by Scalia. And remember, Scalia is viewed as the mentor, at least, for right-thinking conservatives on matters of law and the Constitution. He said, well, there is some ongoing controversy about Justice Scalia's opinion. But he did not want to say that he was going to turn his back on that opinion. If that remains the governing rule, that there cannot be a religious exemption from an otherwise neutral, generally applicable law, then we would ask, how would owners of businesses, restaurants, theaters, this art gallery, deny their services to members of the LGBT community on religious grounds? I think that it will be a very difficult sell, because I think the court is likely to embrace what Scalia said in that 1989 case, and it will find it difficult to view First Amendment religious freedoms as a spear that is not merely a shield to protect their assertions of religious freedom, but as a spear to deny access to public accommodations. I think that's where the court is heading. We should know this next term. So we'll learn a lot about this current court. How does that apply to state laws or indeed city ordinances that might embrace a public accommodations ordinance? That is the issue being discussed right now by the Idaho Falls City Council, or is being discussed as part of a study group. It's being discussed in Salt Lake City, for example. We would ask, what is the controversial part of a public accommodations ordinance when many states across the country have in fact already provided very clear statutory protection on the basis of sexual orientation in places of business, as well as in lodgings, as well as in housing? What's the difference? Why protect housing and the business place, but not public accommodations? What would be the justification for that? When I ask concerned citizens about that, or people in governmental positions in different states, they say that it has a lot to do with an emotional issue. Many will admit they never know whether people coming into a restaurant are in fact a straight or gay. Their concern, I'm told, has everything to do about the use of public bathrooms at parks and elsewhere. If that's the case, then let's see if we can't find a way to find a solution to that problem. Why should that be so difficult? On the one hand, I haven't been in every home across Idaho or across the country, but it's been my experience that people who live in a home share a bathroom. I haven't seen one marked women or men or any other contrasts or degrees. When you fly on an airplane, everybody uses the same restroom. You go all over America and people are using the same restroom. We do find, of course, as you all know, that in public places there is a restroom set aside for women and one for men. This is the emotional part of it, I'm told. This is the ultimate hang-up. Where should a person, what bathroom should a person use who's transgendered, for example? And secondly, why would that be so offensive to so many people? The reality is, anybody using a restroom is probably not likely always to know who's in there, whether they're transgendered or not. I haven't spent a lot of time hanging out in bathrooms, and I haven't questioned anybody to ask, but I'm assuming people are in there doing their business and really not overly concerned about who's in there. What if we simply adopted this solution, that people should use the bathroom that they believe most reflects not only their sexual orientation, but their gender identity? Let people know. If we said that the assertion on grounds of religious freedom was stout enough or broad enough to prohibit public accommodations precisely because some people don't want to be in a public restroom with a transgendered citizen, then we would ask, how come a few people on the assertion of a religious principle get to control this issue across the country? I can't think of another issue where a tiny group of people on the basis of an assertion of a religious freedom would be in a similar position where they can control the outcome of this big public policy matter. We recognize that, again, that religious freedoms are very, very important to people, and that's why the framers enshrined religious liberty in the First Amendment. Very important. People had the right to follow their conscience, as Jefferson and Madison made clear. Made it clear also that people could choose their form of worship. But the founding generation did not create an unlimited right, and the Supreme Court has never held that it's an unlimited right. There have been Supreme Court decisions which certainly seem oppressive to many, and they've been overturned, but nevertheless, the Supreme Court's rulings on free exercise claims often lacks rhyme or rhythm. Let me give you a few examples to show. And over the years, as I've taught my constitutional law classes, I've told my students, be warned, we're entering a little quagmire here, and there's not always rhyme or rhythm here. So consider, for example, in 1879, in Reynolds versus the United States, a case too many familiar here in the western part of the country in Utah and Idaho, there was a law passed by the territorial legislature in Utah that forbade people from practicing polygamy, even though at that point in time, the practice of polygamy was a cardinal principle of that religion. The Supreme Court struck it down on grounds that it was, for lack of a better term, immoral. It was against good public policy. Well, what happens when citizens assert a fundamental belief as justification for engaging in a policy, which is part of the warp and woof of their entire religious complex? Is the government behaving oppressively when it denies people the right to follow their religious beliefs? Contrast that with a case a century later, in 1971, a case called Yoder versus Wisconsin. Notice it's Yoder, not Yoda, for you Star Wars fans. Yoder versus Wisconsin, at issue there, was a state compulsory education statute, common across the country, and that required students to stay in school until they were about 16. Each state had a slightly different age requirement. The children of some Amish parents decided to leave public school after the eighth grade because they believed that after the eighth grade, their children would be plunged into a very materialistic world and it would corrupt their religious values. It would corrupt their entire upbringing. And so they argued a religious exemption from the compulsory education statute. The Supreme Court, in an opinion written by the Chief Justice Warren Burger, upheld the religious claim. Why? Because they said, after the eighth grade, the Amish don't participate much in society. They're kind of withdrawn, a little hermit-like, and they're not going to be able to cause much harm for society. He said, in contrast to the need for compulsory education, because as people go forward in life and participate in broader society, they need more education so that they can be adequate participatory citizens. So here was the religious exemption based on the lack of a harm being inflicted on society. How do you think that advocates of polygamy felt in the contrast between the Supreme Court's decision in 1879 and the court's decision a century later in Yoder versus Wisconsin? Was that an arbitrary decision by the Supreme Court? There have been some pretty humorous cases, I think they're humorous, involving free exercise claims over the years that never prevailed. there was a small religion, call it a cult, that believed that it had a First Amendment right to engage in ritualistic acts with poisonous snakes. Their theory was if they go down into the pit with the poisonous snakes and they emerge, that's God's will. If they never emerge, that's God's will. Well, the court upheld the state law prohibiting the interaction with poisonous snakes. There was another case involving marijuana by a small religious group that again endorsed the theory that it should have an absolute First Amendment right to smoke marijuana wherever, whenever. The court didn't abide by that either. And there was a case of more interest in the late 80s, in a case coming out of a bedroom community in Miami, Florida, and you'll love the name, the Church of Babalu, or at least that's how I read it. I'm sure I'm slaughtering that word. Anyway, that church believed in the ritualistic sacrifice of live animals. The city, however, city of Hialeah, had a strict prohibition on the sacrifice of animals. When the case got to the Supreme Court, however, the Supreme Court decided to uphold the free exercise claims of members of the Church of Babalu because the court said it's an ancient religion, over 500 years old. Here the court was weighing in on the importance of a historical factor, indeed a great historical factor, but it provided that the city could regulate this free exercise of religion by indicating where the animals could be sacrificed and in the most painless way possible. So we see a smattering of Supreme Court decisions on a variety of free exercise claims. That's why I say it's hard to predict when the court will uphold free exercise claims. But if we look, for lack of a more specific description, if we look at the fact that the court often weighs in on the grounds of whether or not the practice will harm the practitioner or others as a determining factor, then we ask, in the case of owners of bakeries or florists or those who take pictures, refusing their services on grounds of religion, we would ask if they are denied their opportunity to deny their services, is that such a violation of their freedom of religion, or is there a greater harm inflicted on society because owners of businesses are engaging in discrimination based on the sexual orientation of customers? If that becomes the standard, as I suspect it will be, then we'll see that there will not be a free exercise right to deny services to members of the LGBT community. I think there are a lot of questions. I'm going to stop here and see what questions you all might have. Please. Oh, and hang on. Kelly's got the microphone, please. So the whole world is going to hear your question. Thank you. I will. Sure. Thank you. Yeah.
Why can they say that's a religious?
Sure. Yeah, thank you. So it's a very good question, and I can't speak to the particular viewpoint of the LDS Church or other churches, but there are practitioners of particular religions who believe that homosexuality is a sin, and they'll cite Leviticus and other clauses to say, here the Bible describes it as a sin. Therefore, they do not want to participate in the sinful act. And that's what Justice Ginsburg wrote in her dissent. The sale of a cake doesn't constitute an exercise of speech or religion. It's just a cake or a cookie, right? But there are members of religious fundamentalists who do believe that it is sinful and they don't want to participate. In the same way, so to give you an example of yet another case, back in 1940, in a case called Minersville versus Gobitis, the Supreme Court had before it a case brought by some members of the Jehovah's Witnesses. the children in that town, Minersville, Pennsylvania, like children all across the country, began each school day by saluting the flag, or they were required to salute the flag. The parents, the Jehovah's Witnesses parents, told their kids, don't salute the flag, because under our religion, paying homage or homage to a flag is paying homage or homage to a graven image, and that would violate our religious beliefs. So when the Gobitis kids showed up in class and refused to salute the flag, then you can imagine the teacher's reaction. She said, why aren't you going to salute the flag? And the children responded, well, because it's a graven image. And the teacher was fearful that other students might hear, it's a graven image, and then the whole class would stop saluting the flag. So the student was sent to the principal's office, same reaction. The students were expelled at a school board hearing. Of course, the school board upheld the expulsion, and that necessitated an appeal all the way to the Supreme Court. In 1940, the Supreme Court upheld the state law requiring school kids to salute a flag, ruling against the free exercise claim. Now, why? It's particularly important because for the Jehovah's Witnesses, that was an issue of central importance, a central principle, and they could risk eternal damnation if they violated those essential principles. The Supreme Court, in an opinion by Justice Frankfurter, exalted the claims of national security over the claims of freedom of religion by saying, as Frankfurter wrote, war clouds loom over Europe, and the United States may be dragged into this war. The best way to protect and to promote national unity is for all citizens to salute the flag. And those citizens who refuse to do so on grounds of religion will nevertheless have to violate their religion. And he wrote a short paragraph. He said, I'm not unmindful of the persecution of Jehovah's Witnesses. As he wrote, as a Jew, I am among the most persecuted in world history. So I'm well aware of this. But national security needs have their claim. Poor Justice Frankfurter was vilified, even though at that point he was the champion of civil liberties in America, a title that he had richly earned. 3 years later, the same case, the same issues come back before the Supreme Court in a case called West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett. This time, the Supreme Court reverses itself by saying, in a landmark opinion by Justice Robert Jackson, that in fact, the requirement that people should be made to salute the flag not only offends religious liberties, but offends free speech. And he said, what an oddity that in America in 1940, that citizens are being required to salute the flag at the very time across the Atlantic when Hitler and Nazi Germany are requiring their citizens to salute Hitler. And he said, in a beautiful way, there's an inner sanctum of the mind that is off limits to the government, grounded in freedom of religion, that conscience that we are entitled to. And that marks the difference between a democracy in America and a totalitarian system in Europe, that we have to protect this inner sanctum of the mind, which is off limits to the government, where we are free to think our thoughts politically, spiritually, religiously, and otherwise. So you can see, as I mentioned earlier, that the Supreme Court will sometimes uphold free exercise claims, other times it won't. Usually, I think it hinges on a harm test, for lack of a better word. Thank you. Where are we? Over here to the, oh, right there, please. Yeah, as long as you're there. Wait, could you explain that concept, please? So, thank you. This concept of unisex bathrooms are very common all over the country. Some of you, I apologize, excuse me. It's this lingering bronchitis. At any rate, some of you visit restaurants in this city that have only a single bathroom. It always occurs to me that people who might be offended about the availability of a single bathroom as opposed to a distinction between men and women or other kinds of divisions can either choose not to frequent that restaurant or place of business, or they can run across the street and find another place, as opposed to asserting their religious interest to govern the bathroom policy of a given business. Mm-hmm. Right here in the front row, please. That's a wonderful question, asking if the courts ever really examine the sincerity of the assertions of religious interest. I was just going to put my coffee here, and then I remembered an unhappy time when I did that at one of these sessions, and I knocked it over. So I won't do that. That's a great question. How does the court address the sincerity of a religious conviction? Let me take you on a quick 3-minute tour of the constitutional law governing a conscientious objector status. Probably some of you have known conscientious objectors going back to the Vietnam War and so forth. I read about that war in history books. That's how I learned about that. At any rate, our story begins in World War I, when some people wanted a CO status because they thought it violated their religious interest. The court granted a CO status to religions which exalted as a central principle the principle of pacifism. That was great for Quakers. Quakers got conscientious objective status. But you could see how that decision would discriminate against others who might, for religious convictions, believe war's wrong, or for people who are non-believers, believe that for philosophical reasons, war was wrong, they would not receive any protection. Move forward quickly to World War II as the Supreme Court confronts the CO status again. This time, the court holds that people are entitled to a CO status if they can either invoke a specific principle within the confines of their religious doctrine, or they hold a view which is the equivalent of a religious objection, then they too will receive a CO status. So you see the court liberalized to a degree the protections afforded to those who want a conscientious objector status. But note that even though the court has expanded the availability by saying that it's available to those who hold a religious-like opposition to war, that is still discriminating against people who are pacifistic, maybe as pacifistic as Quakers or any other member of an organized religion, but are asserting it on philosophical grounds. Move forward then into the Vietnam War in the mid-1960s. Now the court holds that, in fact, people are entitled to a CO status if either they can identify a specific religious principle within their religious doctrine, they hold a religious-like opposition to war, or in fact they hold a sincere, conscientious belief that war is wrong. When the court rendered that decision, that led to the demise of the draft, because there was no way for the registrars at the draft board to discern whether somebody had a sincere opposition to war or whether they were simply paying lip service to the concept. That led to the end of the draft. There's no way for the court to engage in a quote-unquote examination of religious beliefs to know whether it's sincere or not. And Justice Scalia said as much in his opinion in the Oregon case, the Smith case, coming out of Oregon. So if the court utilizes an old test asking, well, does the participant really believe in saying that as a sincere religious opposition, there's no way for the court to examine it. The court has long waffled on the question of if it can even adequately examine the legislative intention of a body, and it struggled with that and gone both ways, I would say, on that. Good question. Where else are we? Over here, Kelly, please. It's a very good question about the invocation of religious doctrine to avoid or to deny medicinal treatment or some other treatment, often by parents of children who are opposed to transfusions, or Christian Scientists, for example, who believe that their children should not receive medical treatment. What happens in that kind of a situation, and it's very similar to what we're talking about, as Justice Kennedy would frame the issue in the Masterpiece case, the state has broad authority to pass laws to protect its citizens under what we call the police power of the state. That is the authority of a state to pass laws to promote the health, morals, welfare, and safety of its citizens. It's not absolute, but it's broad. Versus the religious principles of, let's say, Jehovah's Witnesses or Christian Scientists who either don't believe in transfusion or believe that it's God's will whether their children will emerge healthy or not. In that case, judges all over the country have rendered rulings ordering medical care for those children, thus exalting the state's interest in protecting citizens over and above the interest of religion. And we almost always find in these cases that it's a balancing test. One way or the other, the courts must decide which right or which assertion is deserving of primary weight and which right or assertion will be relegated to a secondary or residual right. And that can engender a lot of criticism, because those who disagree with the court's decision might cry foul and say, well, that's an arbitrary court, for example. But that's a very good example of how of a sensitive area involving religious rights. And you can certainly understand how parents whom the court has held enjoy a Ninth Amendment right to raise their children as they see fit. But again, that's not a categorical right. That's not an absolute right. If you're wondering how does the Supreme Court find in the Ninth Amendment the right to raise your parents, right, the right to parents need help how to raise your children, the Ninth Amendment has a catch-all clause, and it provides, quote, the enumeration in this Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage other rights retained by the people. Meaning this is a clause which invites implied rights. If you're wondering why was that included in the Bill of Rights when James Madison introduced it, because Madison was very aware and indeed fearful of the idea of listing all the rights or liberties that would be granted to the American people. The danger he expressed to his fellow members in Congress on June 9, 1789, when he introduced the Bill of Rights was this. What if we forget to provide a right? What if we forget to set it down on paper? If we operate on the principle that the only rights that the American people will enjoy are those that are listed or enumerated, and we omit an important one or two, then how are we going to protect the assertion of those other rights? And ironically, on the day that he introduced the Bill of Rights, he forgot a pretty important one, namely free speech. His fellow Virginian Mason said, well, I'm sure Jimmy has just forgotten to add free speech. So the Ninth Amendment is a protection against that. Again, the language says the enumeration in this Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage other rights retained by the people. And the Supreme Court, often in controversial decisions, has found the protection for certain rights, implied rights, in the Ninth Amendment, including the right of parents to raise children, or the right to privacy, for example, or in 1965 in Griswold versus Connecticut, the right to use contraceptive devices for married couples, and so on and so forth. But the decisions by the court grounded in the Ninth Amendment are often controversial because the Ninth Amendment is so broad, and people accuse the court of creating or inventing rights, which the court may not do. The court has no authority to invent or create a right. Rather, the court has to find or discover or discern a right that's always been in there, as if the court pulls up its sleeve into this reservoir of the Ninth Amendment and, oh, aha, a right to raise your children. It would violate the power of the judiciary if it created a power as much as if it created a right or liberty. That must be done through the amendatory clause. So the court plays a little game of fiction and says, we've found this right, we've discovered it after all these years. It's always been there. A question right here, please. That's a very good question about the controversial practice of conversion therapy. The state of Utah, for example, has passed a law prohibiting conversion therapy, as have other states, as cruel. The reality is that while you point out that some religions have embraced that as a necessary step to redeeming members of their religion who have become wayward members, because it's based on the premise that people are not born straight or gay, but rather make the choice. And if they're making this choice, depending on which religion you're talking about, some of these people might have been misled by the devil incarnate or by other wayward souls. So it's important. So when we get to testing this in court, as you ask, we'll see, I'm pretty confident, that the courts are going to say that nobody can be required to submit to conversion therapy. It would violate free speech rights. It might violate an individual's freedom of religion. It would certainly violate freedom of conscience as well, and freedom of privacy. You could adduce several different provisions in the Bill of Rights to protect against forced conversion therapy. Yeah, good question, thank you. Please.
So where are you with your book?
No, what you're missing is the completion of my book. Thank you. No, I appreciate that question. Thank you. So I've enjoyed getting these questions from audiences. What's the progress of your book? It tells me that I probably made a mistake in ever telling people I was writing a book, right? Because then where is it? I've made a lot of progress. I'm negotiating with a publisher right now to get a contract that I find useful. So given that, I expect it to be out in about 9 months. So.
Have you asked who the publisher is?
Well, I can't really say, not yet. If I say and it doesn't turn out to be that publisher, then it would be embarrassing, probably more for me than the publisher. But I'm excited. This is my preferred publisher. The question goes to the book I'm writing about Reed versus Reed, the landmark 1971 Supreme Court decision in which the Supreme Court transformed law for American women in a case originating in Idaho, and for the first time in our history holding that gender discrimination violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And that's the case that made then Professor Ruth Bader Ginsburg a household name, launched her career. And I'm so happy that she's agreed to write a foreword to the book. And so I'm excited. And I'll just share a little bit of, and she's been so gracious. We're all busy people. If I send her an email question on a Tuesday, usually I get an answer on Wednesday, and she's pretty busy. I think that's instructive for all of us who lose emails or forget to return. And let me leak a little bit of good news, so just because you're the hometown favorites. In our conference in Sun Valley that we hold each year, a two-day conference called Conversations with Exceptional Women, just a little longer conference than we have here in Idaho Falls, which is a one-evening conference. Next year in 2020, Justice Ginsburg has committed to coming. And I'm ecstatic. Not just her, bringing along her daughter and granddaughter, all were also stalwart lawyers in the cause for gender equality. And the idea appealed to me because three generations of family members fighting for gender equality. So I'm thrilled. Don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody. Okay. Thanks for asking. Yeah.
A couple of the examples. How do we do that? How does that become some kind of a legal...
Yeah, great question. General question probing the ascertainment of an actor's intent. And of course, this is important in criminal law because you're going to charge somebody with intent to commit a crime. That's familiar to us. It's in the area of speech where it becomes much more controversial. So let me give you a little review. Back in the 1950s, the Supreme Court tried to draw a distinction between the speech and the intention of the speaker. And so the court began fumbling with a doctrine that would allow governmental officials to stop a person from speaking if the governmental officials believed that what the speaker was going to say might incite violence on the grounds that it was going to protect the community. But of course, that was a difficult standard to apply because A, you would not know exactly what the speaker was going to say beforehand, and B, you would not know if audience members engaged in violence or engaged in criminal acts precisely because of what they heard. So it would be the further problem of attributing the influence of the speaker to the exercise of violence, right? The Supreme Court clarified it, or thought it clarified it, in 1969 in a case out of Ohio, where the court said that the only justification for preventing a speaker from speaking is if the speech itself is likely to incite immediate unlawful action. And that would be a judgment call for the law enforcement officials at the time. And of course, speakers are capable of masking what they say. And then audience members are probably pretty free to be fast and loose about what motivated them to engage in violence. When we turn to hate speech and its impact on conduct, which can become a hate crime, then we're asking essentially the same question. If we look at somebody who perpetrates a crime, as the shooter in El Paso did, and it's being investigated for the possibility, or I would say likelihood, that it was hate speech that turned into a hate crime, one way to examine it is to see, did the person engage in any writing? Well, we have in the past discovered some manifestos from racists who have invoked various lines and writings as to why whites need to be supreme in this country. There's little doubt about that being hate speech. In this case, of course, this speaker, as you all know from the news, actually has invoked some of President Trump's own language to justify his shooting, including citing President Trump's line that we are the victims of an invasion and an infestation, and we have open borders, we need to protect ourselves. So there'd be an intermix. However, whatever degree of influence President Trump's speeches or writings may have exercised on this very sick man, nevertheless, this shooter was a racist. He drove 600 miles from Dallas to El Paso to find Mexicans to shoot and kill. And so that's very definitely, I'm sure, a hate crime, hate speech that turns into a hate crime. When we have people targeting people of color, it's pretty clearly an exercise in hate crimes. And people sometimes wonder, why do legislatures append extra penalties for acts that are grounded on race? Well, the answer is that our society has a right to establish certain values, to say we want to preserve and protect certain values. Some activities are particularly heinous because we're committed in this country to equal protection of the law, and we have all kinds of statutes that prohibit discrimination based on race or color. We have every right, legislatures have every right, to add an extra penalty, either, we hope, as a deterrent or grounds or foundation for a greater punishment or a sanction against people who violate these foundational values of our society. I say that because every once in a while I'll see in the Post Register a concern expressed about hate speech and hate crimes. Why not just prosecute them like anybody else? But in the same way that our legislature draws distinctions between felonies and misdemeanors, so too can we add penalties for behavior which is particularly heinous and violates our most fundamental values. Good question. Yeah, thank you. How are we doing, Kelly? Any other questions? I guess we're just about at the end of our time together. Any last questions, comments, criticisms, complaints? Back there, Pat. Pat has one of the above, either a question, a comment, a criticism, or a complaint. This is still a democracy, so complaints are welcome.
About overturning Roe v. Wade and LGBTQ rights.
Excellent question about the court's disposition toward the future of Roe versus Wade and more generally about LGBT rights. Well, that's a very good question. We don't know for sure. When Justice Kavanaugh was questioned at the Senate confirmation hearings, he answered the Senate judiciary by saying he believed it's an important precedent. He wouldn't go beyond that. He wouldn't say, as Arlen's former senator from Pennsylvania, Arlen Specter, used to say, Roe versus Wade is a, quote, super-duper precedent. I like that. Cannot be revoked, cannot be overturned. So we would not expect anybody testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee in this era to say anything other than they respect precedents. Doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to embrace the precedent. Doesn't mean that they're going to overturn it. What we have seen already in a couple of opinions by both Gorsuch and Kavanaugh is that the court should reserve the right to overturn precedents which are not well-grounded in the Constitution. And to many people, that strikes a chilling feeling that if they determine that Roe versus Wade is not well-grounded, not firmly anchored in text or legislative history or a slate of principles, then they would feel free to overturn it. On an academic level, we would always say the court's always free to review precedents and to determine that no matter how old a precedent is, if it's flawed, then the court should act to overturn it, because why should we persist in what we might call judicial error? When the court began to interpret the 14th Amendment to uphold corporate rights, that began in 1886 in a Supreme Court decision, and just a couple of terms ago, both Justice Sotomayor and Chief Justice Roberts asserted if that ruling is not defensible, the court should be willing to re-examine it. Think about that. The idea that that corporations have 14th Amendment rights, which seemed unassailable because I don't do math very well, but isn't that about 130, somewhere between 100 and 300 years old? The very fact that Supreme Court justices would say they could review these old cases rings true in the sense that the country should not be governed by judicial error. But that was a decision that was clearly a reflection of judicial error. Here's why. In that particular case, the court never heard an argument to the effect that corporations have 14th Amendment rights under the Due Process Clause. Not an argument before the court. When the clerk of the court came to the Chief Justice, and that day it was Waite, it's 1886, and said, well, I'm writing the head notes, that is the syllabus for the case, so, and that's a quick way for people to scan the Supreme Court's decision to see what the court has said about the issues before it. The clerk said to Chief Justice Waite, well, I'm going to include a head note here that the court finds that the 14th Amendment protects corporations as a matter of due process of law. Chief Justice Waite's response was something like, well, we didn't argue it, but I assume that's a safe conclusion. I assume that's a safe conclusion. So that's why you find in the head notes that corporations have 14th Amendment rights. Justice Sotomayor a few years ago said, maybe it's time to re-examine that decision, particularly in light of the way the court in recent years has utilized the 14th Amendment to expand First Amendment free speech rights for corporations and also religious rights for corporations. Speaking of the expansion of religious rights, it's a key way in the Hobby Lobby case why a corporation could invoke a religious principle to refuse to supply contraceptive devices to their female employees. I always like Justice Ginsburg's dissenting opinion in that case when she said, well, I've never seen a corporation on its knees praying. And then Pat also asked about the future of LGBT rights. I think that it's hard to know what the disposition is of Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, but if they engage in a process that we might describe as original intention jurisprudence, which is their want in the practice of Justice Clarence Thomas, they'll start at the beginning and they may say, well, there was no protection for members of the LGBT community, or that is to say, homosexuals at the founding. We didn't get any protections for many, many years. Therefore, the Supreme Court decisions carving out protections for, as they would say, for homosexuals to engage in sexual activity is without foundation. That was Justice Scalia's perspective, as he set forth in Lawrence versus Summers, a pretty angry dissent. He believed the court had been creating a right which was not protected in the Constitution. If that's their perspective, and they are joined, as I say, by both Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, which I think is not far-fetched, then the whole power hinges on Chief Justice Roberts, because the four progressive members of the court are going to act to uphold LGBT rights. So imagine, if you're the Chief Justice under this scenario, the immense power that you exercise. At this point, you are the swing vote, just as Justice O'Connor used to be the swing vote, and then it was Justice Powell. Good question. Well, all right, I think, oh, one more. Colette has a question. Please, Kelly, right over here in the second row. Thank you.
Did they go back and reverse rights for women and African Americans? Mm-hmm.
Very good question. By that reasoning, by which we mean a reassessment of all precedents that sought to expand the meaning of the 14th Amendment beyond its narrow purpose of protecting the newly freed man, trying to put blacks on par with whites in the eyes of the law, which was its stated purpose, that could allow for a wholesale reexamination of all decisions involving minorities and women. Apart from those specifically the subjects of the 14th Amendment. That would mean that no right is safe, but then you get into the reality. Would the Supreme Court really now, at this juncture in our history, decide that women are not deserving of equal protection of the law? Would we turn back to the clock to the point where women could not work in taverns, could not own taverns? Turn back the clock to 1961, when there was no constitutional right under the 14th Amendment for women to serve on juries because they were too fragile to become involved in such complicated, heated decisions. Would we really turn the clock back? You would have to find five very passionate members of the court who would do that. I rather doubt it. But I'm not at all together confident about the future of Roe versus Wade. After all, the court doesn't have to simply say, today we overturn Roe versus Wade. Rather, it can uphold state regulations that chip away at a woman's fundamental right to an abortion by eliminating more venues where abortions are performed, for example. That would be the way that the right wing would try to chip away at Roe. It's kind of a grim note, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let's end on a happy note. We have a happy question over here, maybe, Kelly. Or maybe not, and that's okay. Oh, yeah, good question. What are the chances that the court would overturn that 1886 decision holding that corporations don't enjoy 14th Amendment protections? Probably not likely. I think because we say that the older a precedent is in our system, the more weight it deserves, the more respect it is entitled to. Because if we overturn decisions 150 years or 200 years old, we would completely undermine the stability of our legal system. And what we aim for in our legal system, going all the way back to the introduction of the common law, is both stability and predictability. People need to have a reasonable expectation of what the law will permit in terms of behavior. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes used to say, when he was asked, what's the law? And he would always say, well, the law is a function of what the criminal can get away with. That's how we determine the scope of the law. So I think we're not likely to overturn old decisions. Please. Oh, yes, not to raise a controversial case at all. Thank you for that question. It's a very important one. Of course, right after Citizens United was handed down, Justice Kennedy acknowledged that he had probably not fully understood the impact of all the campaign expenditures. Nice of him to acknowledge, and he said if he had to do it all over again, he might vote for the other side, which would have brought about an entirely different ruling. Always people are shopping for cases to bring to the Supreme Court to give the court an opportunity to reevaluate its decision. Under the current composition of the court, I don't think it's likely that Citizens United would be overturned. But after maybe another presidential election and the retirement of a few justices, the composition of the court can change. It's interesting, by the way, when we talk about the impact of the composition of the court, the very fact that many fear the court has become increasingly politicized by virtue of the increasingly politicized nomination hearings, Senate Judiciary Committee hearings, the perception that some justices are behaving politically. We have seen a regeneration of the idea of term limits for Supreme Court justices and federal judges as a way of protecting against the effort to pack courts or to infuse the courts with a particular political brand. That's catching some traction. I myself have come to the point where I'm in favor of term limits for federal judges, including Supreme Court justices. I'm not particularly wedded to a particular number. It could be a dozen years, it could be 15. But I'll tell you what has caused me to reach this position where I now embrace term limits. That's because after we saw how Senate leader Mitch McConnell in the last year of President Obama's presidency refused to hold hearings on the nomination of Merrick Garland, who was the chief judge of the DC Circuit Court of Appeals, who was greatly admired by many conservative senators, including Orrin Hatch, just so he could prevent Hillary Clinton from having the opportunity to appoint, and hoping that a Republican, he could not have known it at that time, but a Republican might be able to nominate somebody different than Merrick Garland. The very fact that the Senate confirmation process is now being manipulated makes me now a believer in term limits. Because frankly, if it was Senate leader Mitch McConnell this time, it could well be a Democratic leader next time. I don't like that. I want the confirmation process to proceed with integrity and not the politics of the moment. So that's why I've come to embrace term limits for federal judges. Well, thank you so much for coming out tonight. Really appreciate your great questions. Thank you very much. We'll see you soon. We'll send out an email for our next meeting. Thanks again.